listening to the AHDB podcast, farming news and stories from across the UK.
Welcome to the AHDB podcast. I'm Jane Craigie. I'm your host for this episode. And I'm recording this at the AHDB Agronomist Conference, where I caught up with two of the speakers, Dr. Neil Paveley from ADAS and Phil Jarvis, who's a farmer and also chair of the Voluntary Initiative. The dominant focus for the conference was IPM. So let's find out more. We're going to enter the world of IPM, and it's not a new world, and it's been a dominant focus of the conversation at the Agronomist Conference this year, 2021. And Neil, integrated pest management, or IPM, has been at the heart of almost all of the discussions today. Why has so much attention been focused on IPM practices, given that the principles are already so embedded on how farmers currently farm and have farmed?
Yes, well, that's right. I mean, principles of IPM have been around for decades. I can remember being taught about them at university, which is quite a long time ago now. I guess the main thing is that we are implementing IPM, even if we don't necessarily always recognise that we are. But the bit of information I always think about is the assessment plan, or the IPM assessment plan, which is run by the Voluntary Initiative and NFU, where farmers can go in and fill out a questionnaire that records their IPM practices. And that results in an IPM score. And what that shows pretty consistently is farmers, on average, achieving a score of about 70 out of 100 is the sort of national average currently. So that suggests there's quite a lot of IPM going on already, but also quite a headroom for further implementation. So, yeah, I think that's why we're still talking about it.
And we'll go into more detail in a minute about some of the work that you've been doing around IPM, but just for sake of clarity, please could you define what IPM means in the context of today, in your view, and the tools that farmers have access to, and also what is required of them in the future?
Yes, well, I mean, we've been through decades of quite high dependence on pesticides, and at its simplest, I'm just viewing IPM as a broadening out of the methods of control that we implement. I look at it in the kind of, well, perhaps we look at everything in the COVID context now, but we've got a strategy for COVID control that's highly dependent on vaccines, and then we get the Omicron strain come along, and we're all asking ourselves, well, if that overcomes the vaccines, then are we going to go back to square one? And similar kind of principles apply to loss of pesticides, to resistance and regulation. So broadening out the methods of control just seems a sensible option.
All about good practice, isn't it? Which is something that's going to be absolutely crucial going forward.
Yes. And when you talk about tools for IPM, I mean, there's a lot of talk and hype about sensing and decision support and various platforms and so on, and those are going to play an increasing role, clearly. And perhaps I would say this at an agronomist conference, but it seems to me the role of agronomists in this is crucial, to bring together the information and turn the guidance into farm-specific advice. And the agronomists are already and have already been moving in that direction. So I'm sure that will continue.
Yeah, I'm sure as well. And at the conference, you discussed two important reports. Please, could you outline the scope of each of them and how they will be used by the industry and also policymakers?
Yeah, OK. So the first of the reports is about a review that we did for AHDB on preventative measures for controlling pests, weeds and diseases. So a team in ADAS reviewed the global literature and sources of information on IPM. So there were something over 500 papers that they went through and tried to condense those down for the UK context. And what we were asked by AHDB to do, which was a bit of a challenge, was to try and score the different IPM interventions for how effective they're likely to be, the strength of the evidence for their effectiveness, and how easy and cost-effective they would be to implement, and to use those scores to try to prioritise future research and also to prioritise where there's already good evidence for knowledge exchange activities and guidance to the industry. So that was the first of the reports. And the second report is about an environmental land management IPM test and trial, which many people might be aware of. There are small-scale projects testing out different parts of the potential ELM and Sustainable Farming Initiative or incentive scheme. And this was one of them focused on IPM. And that project was led by the NFU, and ADAS and SIUC delivered it. And it really had three main aims. The first was to understand what farmers perceive as the barriers and incentives to IPM uptake. The second was to develop a tool that would help farmers create land management plans for IPM. And the third part of it was to find out what level of guidance or advice was needed in order to be able to create those land management plans. So that will hopefully feed forward into pilot studies before ELM is implemented for IPM, hopefully in future.
And Neil, that latter report that you talked about, the IPM test and trial report, it did also touch on the payment mechanisms specific to IPM within ELMs. So could you let us know what the findings were on that particular point and also on the wider areas of reporting within that?
So obviously payment mechanisms are partly technical and partly political. And probably on the political side, you might be better asking NFU and DEFRA. From my point of view, from a kind of technical point of view, the question is about how farmers should be incentivized to make use of IPM interventions that are known to be effective and how to be guided towards those. So I think the crucial next step is going to be how the land management plan work that we've already done would relate through to SFI standards, because it's the SFI standards, that will unlock the payments potentially in future. So what I'm hoping will happen in the new year is a co-design process of those standards between government and industry.
Which would be hugely valuable in making practical recommendations as well as, you know, deciding on what the best financial approach and reward is.
Yes, I mean, there are some who view IPM in almost a kind of religious way, but for the vast majority, it's an entirely practical thing, and we want to make sure the standards have practical and worthwhile aims.
And within the AHDB IPM review report, you studied 40 IPM strategies and 80 of the most significant crop pests affecting oilseeds, potatoes and cereals, as well as weeds and diseases. Which IPM practices were most effective in controlling those issues?
Okay, well, that's a pretty big question. Yeah, if you multiply 40 by 80, I think you get to about 3,000 possible combinations of pests and control methods that could be used against them. Of course, only a subset of those are kind of potentially relevant. You wouldn't do the same things to control black grass as you would use to control late blighting potatoes. But when we whittled them down, we still ended up with about 600 that were potentially relevant combinations of pests and control measures. And I should point out, when I say pests here, it's a kind of shorthand for weeds, insects and diseases. So the report will hopefully be published soon, so folk can go onto the AHDB website, and there are lookup tables in there by pest and by intervention. So everybody will be able to see how those have been scored. But if I just picked out one example, if we took Septoria in wheat as an example, although there are lots of potential IPM control measures, it really boils down to rather a few that are effective. So sowing date and varietal resistance, you know, are clearly being demonstrated to be effective. And then there's a couple more items which have been used to a greater extent on the continent and which could play a bigger role in the UK. So varietal mixtures is one of those, and another is disease prediction and forecasting that again could play a bigger role than it does currently in the UK. So that's just an example, but I'd suggest people go to the report for chapter and verse.
And that point you made about varietal blends, that is something that's come onto the recommended list this year, isn't it? What are your views on the value of blending?
Yes, well, it's a way of limiting the adverse effects of monoculture. So if you're a pathogen or a pest and you find a way of overcoming the host resistance of a particular variety, effectively you've got the whole field, all the neighbouring plants, you can jump from plant to plant to plant, you can overcome the resistance in all of them because they're identical in the field. You can move between fields that share the same resistance genes. So effectively that makes life really easy for pathogens in particular to overcome host resistance. And we see that with yellow rust, and we see that also with Septoria. So if your neighbouring plant doesn't carry the same resistance genes, then when the pathogen tries to jump, it's got a harder job. So in principle, there's a good rationale for it, and there's some quite good evidence from the continent, particularly in Denmark, where it's been adopted really quite heavily in recent years to show that it is helping. So yeah, I think there's potential there for the UK.
And you mentioned Denmark, and I suppose as a nation, they're really crucial for us to look at in terms of how they are managing a requirement to have a reduced application level of crop protection products within their farming systems.
Yes, I mean, all the Scandinavian countries have been going down that track, and Denmark probably in the lead, driven by a very strong public opinion that's reflected through their politics and through their policy, including the implementation of pesticide taxation. So, but also a really strong focus and investment in public funded research to help farmers. So, yeah, both sides of the coin.
And Neil, I suppose it's important to make the point that IPM is not to the exclusion of using crop protection products and other aids for growers. Please, could you sort of give me your view about where you think we're going and how some of the technologies that farmers have access to, like variable rate applications in the future, might help on where and how crop protection products are used in relation to IPM?
Yes, I mean, certainly the role of IPM is to reduce the need for crop protection products, but then having reduced the need, in many cases, that need isn't going to be reduced to zero. So the second component of IPM is ensuring that the level of treatment is now appropriate to the new level of need. Now, in principle, that can be done on a field scale, which is what we do currently, or it can be done meter square by meter square across a field if we have the sensing capabilities and decision algorithms to help us with that. Pests and diseases, there's a lot of work going on the sensing side. At the moment, I would say the hype is a bit ahead of the reality, but there is no doubt that that technology is going to aid us in future and move us towards a more spatial application. Well, I'm less interested in what I think. I'm more interested in what the farmers think and what came out of the IPM Elms test and trial, where the social scientists in ADAS conducted a whole string of interviews with farmers, asking questions about various aspects of IPM. And amongst the most important of those questions were asking what the barriers were in the farmers' perception. And perhaps not surprisingly, the three that come out top, the third from the top, I think, was mindset and habits. And changing mindset and habits for any of us is a challenge. And then the top two, which sort of ranked equally in the responses, were lack of knowledge and understanding was one, and economics was the other. And when we drilled down into economics, the risks associated with the change to IPM featured there. So, you know, I think we need to address the economics and we need to address the knowledge barriers. So I can see Elms and the Sustainable Farming Incentive helping to address the economic barriers. And I can see the type of work AHDB are doing, following on from the review, improving the guidance and delivering good tools for farmers and agronomists, helping to address the knowledge barriers.
So you've touched on support payments, Neil, but what do you think the other potential economic benefits are for farm businesses in terms of cost savings, profitability, and also potentially supply chain relationship gains, i.e. what the end retailer, for example, is looking for? Where do you think IPM might play a part in those aspects of a farm business's profitability?
Yes, well, certainly consumer and voter perceptions are playing a part in this drive, aren't they? But there are others more skilled in that area than me. If I look at Elms and, sorry, if I'm looking at IPM and what it can deliver, for me, it's about being able to maintain effective control in future. You know, we've been running what I would call a kind of just-in-time system of pesticides up until now, where the crop protection industry has pulled a new solution out of the hat, you know, usually just in time, but sometimes not just in time. And I would give, you know, cabbage stem flea beetle, where regulation removed a key tool and we didn't really have a strong replacement, as an example, and now we're kind of pushed into IPM after the event to deal with that, and black grass similarly. So I think we've been playing quite a risky game, and for me it's the kind of long-term economic viability of the industry. You know, to be in a position where it's difficult to grow oilseed rape, it's difficult to grow sugar beet, that's not a good place to be. So that for me is where the economic benefits come. Because if you look at the end, the sort of evidence for the short-term economics of IPM, you know, the evidence is pretty thin, really, not because it's not necessarily beneficial, but just the work is difficult to do. Because to work out the economics of IPM, what do you compare with what? So, you know, if you ask me, do fungicides against Septoria pay? I compare with fungicide treatment without. That's pretty straightforward. You know, when you compare IPM, what does that mean? A particular tactic of IPM or not? A whole farm changing to IPM or not? It's a much more difficult question to answer, I think, those kind of short-term economics. The French, I think, are furthest ahead with that. And some of the data they're producing is looking quite positive. But yeah, it's a difficult question to answer about the short-term economics.
I think France is a very good example as well, isn't it, where it's been consumer and political drivers that have changed the perception of agriculture and what it needs to do. So it's important to look at these other countries to see what might be coming down the road for us here in the UK.
Yes, for sure. But again, France is an example rather like Denmark, where the political push has been accompanied by public funds to enable it. So, yeah, it probably needs those two to make it work.
Yeah, quite right. And I know you're a scientist, Neil, so this may be a little bit of an unfair question, but what do you think are the workable approaches for farmers' support payments to recompense effective use of IPM?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that, but I would come back to the standards within the sustainable farming incentive as being key to that area and making sure we have good co-design of that.
And I suppose like any payment system, it's about defining what the criteria are and farmers recognising what they need to do, that which comes back to your point about advice and support to achieve those standards that are required of them.
Yes, and of course, wherever you draw the line and say one side of this line is going to receive payment and the other side of this line is not going to receive payments, there's always, you know, laying it open to a lot of debate, and I'm sure there will be a lot of debate, but if the co-design is got right, hopefully we can get to a position where there's good consensus.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. I mean, co-design is certainly the right way to go about that. And Neil, a final question for you, which is looking to the future. What part does IPM play in the future of the UK's farming sector and the country's net zero goals?
Yeah, well, the net zero goals is an interesting starting point in a way, because we published some work about a decade ago that looked at the greenhouse gas efficiency of crop production in the UK. And what we showed was that obtaining effective control of pests, weeds and diseases was actually essential to greenhouse gas efficient production. And the reason for that's quite straightforward, that most of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with agriculture come from, well, arable agriculture, come from nitrogen application and its consequences. And nitrogen is applied to build a crop canopy that then photosynthesizes and produces dry matter for yield. If you make all those greenhouse gas emissions associated with the nitrogen and then allow pests, weeds or diseases to consume the canopy or compete with it, that's really not a very greenhouse gas efficient way of going on. So we mustn't lose sight in IPM that first and foremost, we need to obtain effective control, both for economic and wider environmental goals.
I suppose the key word there is in the term IPM, which is integrated. And it's got to be integrated into everything within the business, how you manage your land, how you grow your crops, how you feed your livestock, everything.
Yes. I mean, ultimately, it's a whole farm system that's needed to address these wider environmental goals.
Yeah, that's so true. And Neil, you've come along to the Agronomist Conference and you've spoken about IPM. What's your personal view about IPM and its positive implications for the farming sector going forward?
Well, there's a lot of talk about resilience, and that I think is a large part of it. And I just think very positive the amount of engagement that there has been in the push towards IPM. And again, I would come back to the role of agronomists changing their roles. I mean, if we look back, there was a very strong focus of agronomists writing recommendations for plant protection products, and just the whole role of agronomy in implementing IPM at that kind of whole farm level, I think gives me a lot of confidence in future.
Well, thank you very much, Neil, for your time. It's been fantastic listening to your insights on these two really important reports at what is a really important and, you know, almost a pivotal point for farmers in the UK. Next, I talked to Phil Jarvis. Phil, we've heard this morning that IPM is going well and truly up the agenda as far as payments in the future. And there's been a number of reports that have been produced recently, but two specifically that Neil Paveley touched on today. One, the trial and test paper that NFU is putting forward to DEFRA, and the other is the IPM review. What's your thoughts on the two papers that have been produced and their importance?
Well, I think they build on a lot of work that's already gone on in the industry. So there's a lot of things that the industry is doing around IPM that probably haven't been recognised as widely as perhaps they should be. I think going forward, what the future looks like, I think as long as we meld all this information together to make it coherent, practical for farmers on the ground to deliver, I think there'll be useful bits for understanding for the whole industry, not just farmers, but the wider industry as well, about what IPM means into the future.
There's going to be a balance there, isn't there, Phil, in terms of how IPM is built on farm. You know, there's already a lot of farmers that are practicing it well and integrating it well in their farm systems. When do we start thinking about the economics and what you do and what you don't do?
Well, it's going to be key when the National Action Plan comes out from DEFRA, which will hopefully be before the end of the year, possibly the first month of 2022. That economics are recognised in there, certainly in the consultation document. Economics seems to have sort of disappeared. And of course, business profitability, productivity, disease resistance, you know, herbicide resistance, weed resistance, that all of those things are really important. So economics has to play a crucial role, but it is a balance, as you say, about that environmental responsibility. And farmers need to reinvest in their farms, so they do need to make profit.
Phil, you're now chair of the Voluntary Initiative. This must be really good news for the work that you're doing there. How will this add to the conversations that you're having with key influencers and policymakers?
Well, having had a background at the Allerton Project and now moving to a big farming company in Albemarle, I've seen a total spectrum across the industry and about how the whole industry is moving. It does give me the opportunity to use my practical experience and my wider contacts in the industry to try and facilitate not just the industry, so chairing things like the Pesticide Forum brings together other organisations, you know, Soil Association, Sustainable Food Trust, and farmers, agronomists, and government, DEFRA Pesticide Team. It's really important we all talk the same language and we give clear direction to people on the ground. And that's not just farm managers in their office and agronomists, but that's operators on the ground as well.
And in your farming career, you've been a fantastic advocate of IPM and about integrating how land is used for game, for farming, for environmental purposes. When you're making practical decisions on the ground, how do you assess what IPM measures are valuable to you as a farmer and those that are nice to do?
Well, I think what I've been really pleased about in this conference is that IPM is the first thing we're talking about. And it's been in the past AHDB, I've gone around, I've started with a day of IPM. And I think that's the way I go to work. So I look at saying, you know, what's my rotation like? What's my monitoring regime? And also, what are those things that are going to be useful to me economically as well? And so putting IPM first and foremost, the decision process often takes care of itself. There are a number of things I have to sort of prioritise on. the economics is probably in there and really important, but also, you know, the impact I have on my actions on wildlife, on water, on air, they're really important as well. So, I mean, I know I've sort of skirted around that question a little bit, but it's a combination of all those things. But there is a process. If you do the IPM plan, you become ingrained in the process of thinking, how can I do loads of other things before I reach for another part of the toolbox, which is plant protection products.
And today we're at the agronomist conference that AHDB's been hosting. And the question came up about thresholds. And do you think thresholds for pests, weeds, diseases are going to be more important and play a part in how payments are calculated in the future?
Well, the difficulty with thresholds is they can mean lots of different things to lots of different farms. So, you know, we've got lots of different soil types, lots of different cropping systems. Some will be mixed cropping systems, some will be in certain parts of the country which are more vulnerable, for example, from perhaps insects that are coming off the continent, for example. So it's very difficult to have a one-size-fits-all. I think it's the process by which you get there. So selecting, first of all, your integrated approaches, encouraging practices that we know work for increasing things like soil organic matter, better functioning soils, therefore better functioning plants, and then looking around the edge of it about, is there specific thresholds? And this is where your agronomist is comes really useful. They can help you with that.
And you mentioned at the end of your session this morning, you mentioned the importance of measurement, but also not being overly measured. Please could you just elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I think I said in the conference, they know the human resource department on a lot of farms often is the farmer, son and daughter in the business as well. That might be it. And I think the granularity that we want and the degree at which we drill down into the business can often take away from actually what is the primary measure, which is looking after landscape, producing food. So I think we have to make sure that this is something that is practical for farmers on the ground, that they can implement easily without a lot cost of their business. You know, we're up against a lot of trade deals against other countries which perhaps might not spend as much time on an integrated approach. We need to make sure that our government is clear about, yes, environmental responsibility, but it's got to be fit for purpose for farmers on the ground.
That word responsibility is a really important one in this whole debate, isn't it? About how farmers perceive their responsibility and also, I suppose, to an extent, feel that responsibility and that duty of care for the land. How do you think that's going to change as we move forward towards the net zero and the biodiversity gain ambitions?
Well, I think the signposts are there. You know, the 25-year environment plan, ELMS, SFI, all those things are pointing towards a more balanced approach in the future. And I think we'll end up having a system whereby there will be plenty of opportunity there as well. I mean, a lot of times we see it as a threat. You know, farmers are used to being food producers, but in that rural landscape, there may well be lots of opportunities to mean that where areas are good for producing food, we might produce them. Where they're not, we might look after the environment. And of course, there's the compromise position where the land sharing, where some of those production systems that we do produce food on, they may be less intense and have the ability for the environment to play a part in there, especially with things like pollinators, etc.
And you are now working for a different organisation, different farming company. How are you making decisions on where you focus your effort on efficient commercial production and what you take out of production? What tools and what thinking are you putting into making those crucial decisions?
Well, it'd be fair to say that the organisation I've joined has been on the journey and has some solid foundations in environmental responsibility. For example, most of them are all in countryside stewardship higher or mid-tier. We're implementing a training program, so much more rounded, holistic program, not just on the things that are good for food production, but the good things on soil and water, integrated pest management as well, and giving the knowledge to our farm managers so they can make those important decisions around integrated pest management. Economics are crucial. You know, it's no good being in the red if you want to be green. So those points are put across as well, but it's a much more rounded approach. It's building on solid foundations, and hopefully my experience from my previous job will feed into that.
If you want to find out more about the AHDB Agronomist Conference, go to the AHDB website where you'll find the papers and a recording of the day. Thank you very much to our two guests today who also spoke at the conference, Dr. Neil Paveley and Phil Jarvis. Thanks very much for listening.